From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest, who clearly knows more about broadcasting and recording than I do, is Owen Wilson, who I've known for a while, yet this is the first time he's ever sat down here, so I'm thrilled to have him here. He plays somebody in his newest film who's adjacent to public radio, a public broadcasting television star. The film is Paint. First of all, Owen, thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you. It's about time. How long do we have to know each other before I get this invitation to sit down?
At least almost 30 years is what it seems to take.
Yes.
But let me ask you this, because this character, who's based on Bob Ross, one of the things that's interesting about Bob Ross as a person, he never raised his voice because of his World War II experience. And there is this interesting sort of group of PBS stars, Fred Rogers and Bob Ross and Julia Child, who all came from World War II, who all had this really awful experience and decided to basically dial back their lives and try to be more conversational and inviting to the viewer. And I wonder, for your character, where does the voice come from and then him not raising his voice?
I didn't know that about Bob Ross. I think I'd kind of, when they were doing the movies about Mr. Rogers, I was kind of aware of that. But I think with the kind of the voice, well, it's a very soothing, nice voice to hear. And I think that with the character that I'm playing, Carl Nargle, you know, there was something in that, you know, the director, Brick McAdams, also wrote it. And there was a line where I, you know, without raising my voice, say, But clearly I'm upset about this new painter that's coming in. I say to everyone, you know, good night, I'll see you later. And they say, I've never seen him that angry. And so that's, you know, it was kind of clear in the script that this is somebody who's very measured. But you do know those kind of people that without raising their voice, that you can sort of get that they're upset. Yeah, but the actual Bob Ross just has a very nice, pleasant, doesn't even seem to do it justice. It seems more than pleasant. And that's probably why people love him so much.
Charles is a very interesting character who really wants to encourage people, but also doesn't quite seem to be aware of the effects he has on people sometimes. And I want to have you talk about that character a little bit.
Yeah, I think, I don't know, the stuff that sometimes I think can be funny is when someone the lack of self-awareness in Carl is almost clinical. And I think that usually makes for a funny person in real life and also kind of with a character. And going back to, you know, the first time that I acted the character that I played in Bottle Rocket Dignan, you know, not a lot of self-awareness. And I don't know, I just think that can be funny.
Hey, you've done a lot of that, but often these characters have a lack of self-awareness but want to be seen. And Bob is the reverse. He wants to be heard rather than seen. And the voice is about making people listen to him. And there is a benevolence there that clashes with that lack of self-awareness.
Yeah. And also, I think that the thing that I sort of like when a character, you know, doesn't have much self-awareness and much irony, that means they're not trying to be funny. So there's no sort of winking at the audience. It's just kind of who they are. And that kind of earnestness, I think that's also kind of maybe also why, you know, back when you used to rent movies, I wouldn't rent a comedy. There are not many comedies that I thought were really funny. But I could find something funny in, you know, a drama or even something like Raging Bull has, you know, very funny things, but the characters certainly don't know they're being funny. It's just so real.
Because one of the things that kind of, for me, links a lot of your characters is they are mostly sincere. Whether they're being ironic or not, they do want to connect with people.
Yeah.
Some of these people that you play.
Yeah. Well, I think that that wanting to sort of connect is, obviously, it's a very human thing. And I think that the struggle that we all have in life is, you know, sometimes it's easier to connect when you're a kid, you know, the way you can kind of instantly become friends. And as you get older, sometimes it's harder. And I was even talking about this with a friend about how you'll see someone, you go, I feel like, or I remember in that Tobias Wolff book, This Boy's Life, he said that he's always instinctively known people that were meant to be his friends. And I sometimes feel I've kind of, you know, you'll meet someone, you say, I feel like I could be friends with this person. And you wish sometimes that you could get past, you know, the sort of getting to know a person and the awkwardness and just jump right into being friends. And sometimes it's hard to ever overcome that. It's funny when I remember, because I love that book, This Boy's Life. And then later, I went to a book signing, and I kind of expected Tobias Wolff to have that reaction to me when I was standing in line to get my book signed. This is when I was in college, and kind of waiting for him to kind of look at me and say, that guy is meant to be my friend, which didn't happen. But that is, you know, can be sort of one of the, you know, can be kind of an isolating, lonely thing, is that people you do want to connect, and sometimes it's just hard to kind of overcome kind of the barriers that, you know, that we have, that we kind of naturally kind of put up.
It's funny, because that eagerness that you're talking about from Tobias Wolff, there's a kind of almost a cotton coating around that eagerness, because that character starts shielding himself.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I think about that kind of happens here, where people, they start shielding himself against Carl's power, because he does have an eagerness that actually does bring to mind this boy's life. The need to want to be right in front of people.
Yeah. I think that Carl, because of, you know, he's has the number one painting show in Vermont. And so he's coming into people's homes and wherever they're watching him, and he is connecting with people. But of course, it's, you know, it's not quite, you know, like on equal footing, because in that world, he is sort of a star. And whether he behaves badly, I don't think he necessarily does. It starts to probably affect him. He gets used to being, you know, kind of treated differently, and kind of having a lot of people admire him. And then I think that when that is sort of starts to get threatened or taken away, that's not going to feel good to anyone, to all of a sudden, wait, what happened to everyone that admired me? And so Carl is dealing with that. And I think people, you know, can relate to that, or certainly find it funny.
It's a treat when we're talking to an old friend who should be an old friend of the show and finally got here. Owen Wilson, his new film is Paint. You can also see the show at kcrw.com/thetreatment. But as you were talking about that, though, I was thinking about this fascinating set of sort of contradictions, where he lives with the star's perquisites, but there's some part of him intrinsically that wants to reject that, but is too comfortable to reject. So all these elements of him are fighting, which I think makes him one of the most complex characters you've ever played.
I hope so. I know that I just kind of responded to it when I read it. I just thought it was a funny character in a funny world. And usually when I read something, it's more like, well, I can definitely see how we could improve this. Or
you must get a lot of comedy with a capital C sent to you, don't you?
Yeah. And this, it was more a case of, this is really good if we could just get what I'm reading here, deliver on that. And so I was a little bit, you know, almost anxious kind of in the beginning working with Britt, because I did feel it was such a good character, and just wanting to do it as well as the way it was when I read it, the way I heard it in my head. And I'm not good at doing imitations, and you know, couldn't really, you know, ever do an exact voice of someone else or Bob Ross. And so, and it isn't Bob Ross, it's Carl Nargle. And so I, you know, eventually just sort of landed on a version of my voice, but maybe delivered in a slightly different way.
I think the rhythms are different, too, in the way that he doesn't actually sound like you. I was going to ask you about that, because there's a lot of pausing and almost pausing between words that he does.
Yeah. Well, and also, you know, you had sort of said about a complex character and the self-awareness that Carl doesn't have. And in real life, I probably do have, you know, quite a bit of self-awareness, you know, maybe too much, which is why I would maybe be drawn to characters that don't. Yeah, I think with Carl, it's a case of kind of he becomes a little bit corrupted by, you know, the admiration that he's getting from his fans. And then that struggle when that's taken away of how to kind of manage that. And also the idea of, you know, trying, wanting to do something creative. And there's nothing cynical about Carl. He's genuinely wants to paint the perfect picture.
The thing I really sort of responded to is the scene where there's a kind of a paint off during a telethon, and he seems to be shocked by this, by the spirit of competition that rises out of him, which I thought was a wonderful scene.
Yeah. And I think that he sort of, you know, he's feeling this other painter has come along, kind of stealing his thunder and his kind of place in the community. And they have a paint off. And I think he, you know, believes he's just going to sort of hands down win it, but he can't sort of get out of his own way.
That scene for me is so much fun because he's seeing this thing awaken in him. You're talking about corruption that startles him, and he doesn't know quite what to make of it, because even in his being competitive at first, he's being kind of passive aggressive about it, just sort of thing is going to be handed to him. When he realizes that there's something at stake and also that he has to compete, you can see these warring things going on. And we can, actually, more importantly, we can hear it.
Yeah.
Come out of him.
Yeah. And also, to me, what's funny about it is that they're supposed to be painting, you know, a portrait of the person who won the bidding. And so an older lady, you know, she bid on Carl. And so he's, you know, supposed to be doing a portrait of her. But, you know, he's locked into painting that journey of trying to paint the perfect picture. And it doesn't have anything to do with painting a realistic portrait of a person. And so, you know, she's a bit startled when Carl turns it around and is expecting her just to be awed by, you know, the painting that he did. And she's saying, why was I smiling the whole time? She's not even in it. And, you know, Carl is, he's just in way over his head.
I just wonder, in a case like that, where there's scenes, because again, that scene for me is almost kind of boils down the essence of the entire movie in a lot of ways.
Yeah. And also kind of, you know, the pledge drive. And I think that was, you know, that's a big part of public television and stuff, relying on that. And having to do that is sort of protecting, you know, because you're not dealing so much with ratings the way, you know, other networks would be. And so it's sort of a more gentle, creative place to be. And that's where Carl has kind of thrived. And all of a sudden to find himself having to compete, that's a bit of a wake-up call for Carl.
Well, we rely on pledges here at Public Radio, too, but we're not going to ask you for money just yet.
Yeah.
We'll take a break with our guest, our old friend, my old friend, who's now a friend of the show, Owen Wilson. He's starring in the terrific new comedy, Paint. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us. We're trying to maximize and make the best of it, as we do here at Public Radio, with my guest, Owen Wilson. His new film is Paint, It's the Treatment, which you can also read at KCRW.com. I don't want to harp on the scene too much, but it's about his relationship to the community, about what that station means to the community, about what his place there means to him, about this threat that he would never have anticipated that was created by a relationship that he ended. I mean, all these things that are about his lack of self-awareness, but his need to be sincere, for me, boiled down to that scene.
Yeah. Also just sort of, you know, the world of that kind of the pledge drive and, you know, trying to sort of, you know, raise money. There's something kind of odd about, you know, you'll have the thing of that is kind of an interesting relationship between creativity and money. And so Carl has been, you know, insulated from that. And then all of a sudden is kind of competing and trying to raise money. But you have actors like George C. Scott, who I guess won. Did he refuse his Oscar?
He did for Patton. Yes.
And then, you know, the next year, Marlon Brando, he didn't really accept his. And so there is sort of a track record of people saying, well, you know, there shouldn't be competition, or how do you judge between two performances? And, you know, there is something kind of interesting about Carl all of a sudden kind of being, you know, forced into, by his own doing. I think he believes he's going to win this paint-off, but yeah, he sure doesn't.
Well, funny though, we were talking about sort of classic movies before we started, and there's a scene in this movie that took me back to Absence of Malice, where Carl's running from the one lawn to another stealing newspapers.
Yeah, you know, that was something I kind of responded to in the script. And then I think, I forget if they added that or if that was always in there. But to me, the idea of having somebody read a horrible review right to your face is, you know, a little bit like a execution. And of course, there's always curiosity. Well, how would I hold up if you're about to be executed? Would I, you know, break down and start begging and crying? And, you know, of course, you'd hope that you can kind of maintain your composure as somebody is reading this. And so I just thought it was kind of funny. Somebody, it's the woman that he loves, reading this horrible review to Carl right to his face, and him just absorbing it. And seems like he kind of did it with a lot of grace and dignity. And of course, boom, you cut right from that. Him saying, I don't care what people write about me. That's not why I paint. Cut to him, you know, literally running to pick up all these newspapers to try to control it. Because I think most people, you know, do care desperately what people think. And I've had a lot of practice, you know, from making movies for a long time. And it does not feel great to have a terrible review.
It's the treatment, I guess, who's looking away from me as he talks about terrible reviews.
Yeah.
Is Owen Wilson. He's the star of the new film Paint. You can also hear the show KCRW.com. I also wanted to ask you, too, about this. They really also sort of reduce it too by boiling it down to making it about not only just Vermont, but a specific community in Vermont, rather than making it dealing with the nationwide status of that Bob Ross had. Because it really, what that does is all these things we're talking about. It's about how impactful he is on this community and about how he can be himself in some ways and go sit where he wants to sit. And in some ways, it's suddenly like the present catches up with him, because we're not sure when the movie takes place until, as the movie goes on a little, as time passes and he's not allowed to smoke anymore in a restaurant. I won't give away another smoking plot point, but there are all kinds of things.
But it is also kind of, the movie is, I think, takes place in 2009, but clearly Carl is set in 1978. And
just based on the music we hear.
Yeah, I also think it's kind of, if everything is going your way, you don't have much reason to change. And so if Carl's had the number one show and in this community, he has a certain standing and what we were talking about, people admiring him and a passionate fan base, almost groupies that he has. He has groupies.
But he's chased with his groupies.
Yeah, he is. But why would you change? And I think that is kind of true in real life. It's, you know, it's usually kind of pain or something not working that, you know, forces you to change. So, yeah, and that's the way it is with Carl, and he's going to be forced to change. I also like the idea of somebody not changing. I kind of like that with, you know, with a band like the Ramones, that they just don't change, or AC/DC. You know, there's great bands that really evolve, and they're so different from their first album to, I'm listening to this thing on New Order and Joy Division and the way they kind of change. But then there's some bands
they had to.
Exactly. And then there's some that they just keep doing the same thing over and over. And that's kind of nice.
Because so much of the music has the same chord structure. I mean, listening to those, it's like half of them are in the same key.
Yeah.
It's like, oh my God.
Yeah.
It's almost like one of those serious radio stations, that a 70s stage, not only 70s, but 70s kind of hard, soft rock.
Yeah.
Where it's like, oh, no.
Well, that was kind of a, Bob Ross was, a touchstone, obviously, for Carl Nargle, but so was Gordon Lightfoot. And the way he looked on one of those album covers with that jean on denim look. And I think there is some Gordon Lightfoot. I've always loved Gordon Lightfoot.
If you can read my...
Yeah.
Which is a song you almost never hear in movies, by the way.
Yeah, it's a great song, too. It's a heartbreaking song, beautiful song. Somebody was saying that Bob Dylan had said about Gordon Lightfoot, when you hear a Gordon Lightfoot song, you just don't ever want it to end. And that, I feel, certainly applies to that song, if you could read my mind.
When that song starts to play, I said, there's a point where you feel like you're halfway into the song, you realize the song's almost over, just because each verse doesn't relate to what came before it. So you're listening to all these vignettes. And that kind of reminded me of the movie where you go, oh, has that kind of effect where it feels anecdotal, but in fact, each anecdote is sort of advancing or not advancing Carl's emotional journey, but advancing the story. And I wondered if that was something you responded to, that it felt kind of offhanded, but really was really well worked out.
Yeah, I probably didn't have, the awareness of that so much of how, certainly when we're doing it, you don't know what the music's going to be. But I think...
Oh, the songs weren't mentioned in the script?
Well, actually, some of them were. I don't know that one was. But some of them were. When Carl's driving around and everything's going great, that song, Boogie Woogie Something.
Oh, God, that, yes.
Yeah. that was in there. But, again, that was kind of a credit to Britt and the world that he created. And it is very specific, and it just kind of rings true, some of that stuff.
It's so interesting. And talking to you about this, And watching the movie, too, I'm reminded of the work you do with Wes and you guys write together. They're both sort of comedic and melancholic about a person who refuses to move out of a certain era, a person who's trapped in that era. We could go through all the things you've done, but these people refuse to acknowledge that time is changing around them.
Yeah, and I think that would be something that I would hope with the movie, with Pain, is that, obviously, I hope that it's funny, but...
But
I would hope that there's some sort of poignancy and pain in it. And I that can be funny, too, or at least funny in the way that I kind of think of humor as, that it's also a way to sort of cope with life and to, take something, that can be difficult or sometimes almost unbearable and find a way to laugh at that pain. And so I think there's hopefully an element of that with Carl.
I guess I'm asking that question, too, about it, for me, reminding me of work you've done as a screenwriter, because I think we're at the point now, and I wonder if you see this, things are sent to you, where your impact, your influence on filmmakers is emerging, or probably has been for a long time. Speaking of self-awareness.
Yeah, that's nice of you to point out. I definitely sometimes believe that with Wes. You can sometimes, I'll see a commercial now, and it looks... like, God, did Wes do this commercial? Or even sometimes you'll see movies. And so I think his sort of visual style and, that's had a big impact. And then in terms of what is funny now, and this might be a little bit discouraging for me, is that I'll sometimes think about, has there been much progress in sort of from when I was, 24 to now 54 in sort of the way I see things, and I find it's, it's pretty consistent, and it's kind of the same sorts of things that I would have found funny then I still find funny and I guess look for in scripts.
I guess so. This idea that for me comes as much from literature, specifically kind of short story, as anything else. This kind of stuff you guys did. I find this thing of Fitzgerald short stories, all those kinds of things where these things that seem to just be about the passage of time and incident moving to incident and us not getting into the last third, that we realize is that there's been some deliberation in the way these incidents have been arranged. And in the case of this movie, of Paint, I definitely see it there.
I think that there's, you know, there is kind of a bittersweet quality to the story, and that you do identify with Carl, or certainly kind of feel, you know, in a way that's funny, but also kind of what we were talking about, that, you know, there is kind of a sadness to it.
Well, we can take this back to Dignan, though, who was, I mean, I think of you often as being wedded to the comedy of intransigence, where Dignan has decided he's basically a 50-year-old man, even though he's 30 years younger, he's going to live his life that way. And so many of these characters have been there. There's, even in tragic circumstances, there's sometimes comedy in sheer stubbornness.
Yes. I remember there was a Neil Young album, Electronic, I think it was called. You know, it came out in
Trans?
Yeah, and did not get a great reception.
It was Trans,
and
there's Electronic, yeah, here, yes.
And Neil, I remember reading in his book, he said, I'm going back to it, you know, and I'll either be 1,000 years ahead or 1,000 years behind, but I'm going back to it. I'm going to make another album like that. And to me, that's really funny. The idea of, you know, failing terribly in a commercial sense, but not taking a back step. Not only is he not taking a back step, he's going to do another album like that, insane, and I'll either be 1,000 years ahead or 1,000 years behind, but I'm going back. Is that, to me, is really funny and kind of beautiful also.
Well, I guess we're talking about an era or an environment, and by sheer will, sort of, Carl's created this kind of environment around him where things aren't changing, and there is an invitation to try or to be who you are and just keep at that. That's a lovely thing to me. It's kind of fable-like.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm thinking more kind of about Neil Young, kind of about the, you know, something else he said that I think's interesting, is that he says that he would rather play with guys that, you know, play good on a good day and bad on a bad day, like long, flat expanses of professionalism bore him. And I think that's a great way to do, you know, and that would certainly be sort of the ethos of punk, not doing it perfectly. And it's a little bit.
That's what the Ramones
would
tell you, yes.
Yeah, right. And so I think with Carl, you know, he's trying to paint something perfect and not recognizing that it's maybe these imperfections that can be great and can be their own sort of art.
Rather than reminisce any more about Neil Young, we'll say thank you to Owen Wilson and congratulate him on his terrific new film, Paint. Owen, thanks so much for doing this.
Thanks so much for having me. It's nice to be here.
Owen Wilson is a sometime screenwriter, but we know him best for the lilting rhythms he brings to comedy as an actor, which he does in the new movie Paint, which features his take on a real-life painting instructor and public TV legend, Bob Ross. Others can be heard on previous episodes at kcrw.com/thetreatment. And I can be heard always here at The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest, screenwriter, director, playwright, executive producer, Scott Z. Burns, has a particular thesis that he works out, I think, to dazzling effect which is The Dangers of Too Much Information in the Hands of the Wrong People. He was last year talking about that literally for his film The Report in 2019. We know him for such projects, of course, as The Informant and Contagion and The Laundromat. His newest piece for Apple Plus TV, as creator and writer-director of many of the episodes, is the near future dystopian drama Extrapolations. That's a mouthful. Just setting you up, Scott. Thanks for doing this.
Yeah, I guess all the other titles for shows were taken, so we went with Extrapolations.
Well, actually, I want you to talk about that title because it says a lot.
Yeah, I mean, the conceit of this show from the outset for me was people have done some great work about what we think is at the far end of the climate change problem that we currently face. There's movies like Adam McKay's, and there are books that deal with this. And cinema, for a long time, I think, has tried to take on the very existential questions about that environmental devastation raises. I was really taken with what happens before then. What about the messy middle, where there is still an opportunity to change the outcome, where people still have agency? And so we looked at the science as we understood it from IPCC reports and other things, and we sort of looked into the future and thought about how would some of these changes in the world affect the lives of people on both large and small scales.
Well, it's a really telling line in the first part of the episode 2059, where one of the characters says at one point, we're just parents and children. And that really is the through line of the series, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a big generational question that we all have to grapple with right now. It's one thing when you look at periods of history where maybe people didn't fully understand what it meant to be burning fossil fuels at the rate that we are. And then it's another thing to consider more recent generations that did have all of the information and chose to continue down a path. And so now we're seeing a generation come up who are experiencing the results of their predecessors' greed.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess I want to get to that line, though, because each episode is about a family drama, about family conflict, as it relates both to the family dynamics and the really the destruction of the environment.
Yeah, look, I think that we will all live this on the scale of our own lives. And so it's tempting sometimes to make very large kind of proclamations about what the world will look like. But I think the way that it's experienced, no matter what, is on a very human scale. And so, yeah, it's who's in your family, who tells you where to go in the morning. It's about work. It's about all of the things that make up a day.
It's an intergenerational drama that we follow one specific family. Kind of, we can say, sort of the father and the paterfamilias of the show is the character played by Kit Harington, Nick Bilton. Just in following him, that he never really gives a whole lot away. He will only tell anybody what they need to hear at any particular moment. And I thought that was a really striking thing to do with that character.
Yeah, I think that goes on a lot right now in our world, where there are people with a lot of power who are capable of doing things like greenwashing, like playing both sides of an issue, and sort of, you know, very much betting on the opportunities that are going to come from climate change, which is sort of a new thing for all of us to consider. While we were doing the show, in fact, while I was shooting the episode that dealt with the mining of the Arctic for rare earths, there was actually an article that appeared that someone in our art department brought to me saying, oh my God, there's actually billionaires who are looking into mining the ocean floor. And that's not a new thing. It's something billionaires have been doing, and it sometimes disguises itself as sort of extractive colonialism. But again, you know, it's a kind of opportunism where we continue to look at the planet, as Edward Norton says, as table stakes.
It's the Street. We're talking to our old friend Scott C. Byrne, whose newest project as creator is a series for Apple Plus TV, Extrapolations. You can also hear the show at kcrw.com/thetreatment. It seems to be in all of these projects, so many of these projects you've done, that you deal with the seductive power of science and the way it can sort of either embolden or pervert individuals who are seduced by it.
Definitely my process involves looking at things going on in the world around me and looking at science. In the case of Contagion, I was aware of SARS and I worked with the same scientist who had discovered that. And he told me that other possible diseases were going to emerge from the wild and there would be other viruses. I obviously didn't know it was going to be 6 or 7 years after the movie, but the process for me remains the same. I like thinking about where science can lead. What sort of stories does it start to forecast?
And here, it's interesting because there's this interesting pull for so many of the parental figures in the show. It's trying to decide where the line between being a scientist ends and being a parent begins.
That, in all candor, may have had a lot to do with the fact that while I was writing a lot of this show, I was in the process of saying goodbye to my father, who was both a father and at a point in his life, various points in his life, a scientist. But I do think there is an incredible responsibility with the information that we now have about climate change to stand up and say enough. You know, this isn't a question of if this is going to happen. It is happening around us. And certainly those of us in Southern California know that because we see it all the time with fires, with heat. We see it, you know, when we look out at the ocean and know that acidification is happening. The question really for me when doing this was, at what point is there critical mass where people will begin to stand up and ask for accountability?
It's tough for a lot of these characters to sort of separate themselves from the investment in this pursuit of science and the power that it gives them. I mean, we see it with Edward Norton's character, who is trying to sort of decide where optimism is in this investment in science and trying to make this change versus playing to the political world and dealing with his own son. And he ends up creating in his own household a revolution.
Bill McKibben started an organization a few years ago called 350.org. about, you know, what would maybe be the right level for carbon in the atmosphere. And we're now well above 400. So even that asks a question. Let's say we could invent a machine that lowered carbon, but some people have decided to optimize their business idea at 400 parts per million. Who decides how we get to wind it back? And there are huge economic implications with the increase of carbon. It shows up not only in, you know, in the weather report, but on every page of the paper. Building a building that can withstand temperatures like we're headed towards is very different from, you know, building a building 50 years ago. So all of this science ends up spilling over into every other part of your life. When a farm fails in Latin America and someone decides to try and make it into the United States, the science behind crop failures ends up showing up as a family dealing with a crisis at a border. And that happens in this country. It really happens in the global south with farm failures as well. I mean, human migration is predicted by the UN to skyrocket. And yet when we look at 1 or 2 million people like coming from the Middle East into Europe does, these are all really dangerous situations. And again, they all can be traced back on some level to climate change.
I just find myself thinking too, because God, there's so much to talk to you about here, Scott. And we saw it in Contagion, and we saw it to some extent in Side Effects. And definitely here, the aspect of the old science fantasies saw of playing God and what that does to people.
Yeah, that's clearly something I'm concerned about. You know, sometimes I think it's helpful for me to come and speak to you because I begin to learn what I'm doing, because it's easier if you're not trapped inside of me to learn these things. But yeah, clearly that is a concern that I've had my whole life. And I think the trick that I've learned, you know, from our mutual friend Steven Soderbergh and other people is how do you turn this into something that is ultimately a human story? How do you get it down to a scale where you're not telling Sienna Miller or Gemma Chan to be playing? You can't ask them as a director to play the science. You have to get them to play within the confines of a relationship. And hopefully those are the things that secure people's interests.
We're talking about all this information, and each episode starts with a graphic charting the dissolution of the atmosphere.
Yeah, I really wanted to try and infuse this thing with some tension. I think part of what I hoped I was doing was creating a little bit of a thriller, and that as we move forward in time, there is a real sense that time is running out and that we're crossing these threshold issues. And there are things in climate that, you know, are a lot like the relationship between a cucumber and a pickle. Like, you can't turn the pickle back into a cucumber. So when we go across some of these thresholds, we're saying goodbye to the planet as we knew it. And in that regard, I always feel like other shows that pretend that the climate's not going to change, those shows to me are the science fiction shows, because I don't know what that world is. Adam McKay and I have been talking a lot about this lately, that we really need to think about our storytelling differently, because the stage for it is changing at this very moment.
And you talk about Adam, who uses almost absurdism to the point of surreality, and you go the other direction. And I think that one of the other things that links a lot of your work is, at a certain point, they almost put like film noir. And that happens a lot here too. The idea of who's going to be able to profit from this piece of information and who's going to use it. And for all the other kinds of personal relationships and things that are happening, that really still is what the piece is about. The husbanding of information and deciding how it gets disseminated.
I love noir. It's probably going to always be a part of anything that I write, because I do love exactly that. Who has the information, who has been misled, who has been tricked, who will rise up in the face of that and make a sacrifice or do something else, you know, brave and unexpected. When you work in this space, there's a lot of people who come to you and say, well, you got to leave people with hope. And my response is, I actually think the hope experiment we've been running for the last 20 years isn't really turning the ship around. I'd rather leave people with a sense of courage and bravery, and that they're going to stand up to something. And that is something that I think frequently flourishes in noir, yeah.
It's the treatment. My guest who's making me hungry talking about pickles is Scott Z. Burns. His project, his creator, is the series Extrapolations for Apple TV+. You can also hear the show at kcrw.com/thetreatment. I mean, I just find myself thinking so much about, and I want to talk to you about, that this Nick Bilton character, just because the way he talks is almost as if he's aware that he could be recorded. He's never exactly lying to anybody. And that through line runs throughout the entire show. Every time he appears, I just found myself waiting to behold what it was he was going to say.
Yeah, Kit and I spent a fair amount of time at the very beginning talking about making his character the spine of the show. And that if we were going to do that, we couldn't make him easy to dismiss. And that within everything he said, there needed to be some kind of kernel or seed that allowed people to go, well, he's not, you know, entirely wrong. And it is, in fact, that allows us to continue down some pretty unfortunate paths, both in the show and in real life. Because you look at a person who has the power that Kit's character has, and they're never held to account in our world. And I'm sure that the frustrations that I feel about that bubbled over into some of this, that at the end of the day, accountability needs to happen if you're going to get people to stop doing things that they're profiting from in incredible ways. And you need to start questioning their justifications.
For me, that's where the title really comes into play, because that character almost seems to extrapolate everything. And again, it felt like the way somebody in the future might live, where technology has invaded every corner of their life, and they are speaking so that if somebody happens to be able to pull up a transcript or play back what they're saying, it can never be held against them.
Yeah, he is very soundbite savvy, and it was a lot of fun writing that character for that reason. I think he is a creature of in a way, the last century. He is somebody who has been what a lot of people would call a rapacious capitalist, who is willing to give some money to charity to keep the value of the brand where it's at, but really isn't going to change the fundamentals, you know, of how they're profiting. And that to me was something that I really wanted to interrogate, because it becomes so critical that we not continue to subscribe to some narratives that are actually now killing people and killing the planet.
It's interesting because the show goes from very spiritual, religious at the beginning with the David Diggs and his congregation and his family to ending in a courtroom. And I want you to talk about that migration, that movement, where it's so much about feeling versus fact to the end, was again about feeling versus fact in a very different context.
Yeah, there's a moment in episode three that when I wrote it, I felt like, oh, this is really what I'm trying to say. And it's when David, as this rabbi, is talking to a young student who's concerned about an ice shelf breaking off. And he says, well, is it God's ice shelf or our ice shelf? And if it's our ice shelf, don't we have a responsibility to do something about it? And part of that comes from, I think, a misuse of religion and spirituality to say, this is beyond me, it's in God's hands. I have never been comfortable with that. And for me, a lot of my spiritual nourishment has come from nature. And so I don't feel comfortable saying this is in God's hands. And I do not believe, if there is a God, that that's what the intention ever was. I think we're supposed to care and have stewardship about this. And my partner on the show was Dorothy Fortenberry, who is someone who has really integrated her Catholicism into her life and her work in a beautiful way. And, you know, she loves what this Pope has said about our responsibility to the planet. That being said, to me, as I went through the process of going, okay, so how do I get to an end? And I don't want to do a plot spoiler, but, you know, we don't wipe out mankind, so it's safe to watch the show. Everyone lives in the end, although I hope they live a little differently. What is missing to me is that we don't seem to yet be prepared to hold people accountable. And there's a line, you know, that the prosecutor says in episode 8, what do we do about the people who knew better and failed to act? What is the name of that crime? And that to me is a very emotional notion. And I think in the absence of divine intervention, we need to really think about what resources do we have to hold the people who are driving this problem to account.
It's funny because I was thinking that that story that David's character tells as the enormous disaster is taking place, that takes us back to almost the last line of the show. And I don't think I give too much away, but something that lawyer says on the beach, I can sort of presage it by saying that story that he tells about, you know, he said, well, it ends with, I gave you all the tools you needed. What else was I supposed to do? And she basically says the same thing. And he was saying it's not hopeful, but also it does end with hope. But it's also, too, that anecdote that the rabbi tells lands right back at the very end with what the lawyer is saying.
Yeah, and that was very conscious, because what I wanted people to take from this is that this is no longer a problem without a solution. It is a problem with a lot of technology that we can start putting online, that would slow down climate change, which would give us more time to find even more solutions. So at the end of the day, you kind of got to go, well, why aren't we doing that? And it's because there are people who are profiting from it being just the way it is. And so to me, the solution is more about how do we treat each other if we have all these tools? Because the problem is us. And by the way, I think that Al Gore was saying that when we made An Inconvenient Truth, you know, almost 20 years ago, was that the solutions are there. We just need to start employing them. And when we do, there are a lot of really beautiful things that can happen. And that I am very hopeful about.
I have to say, too, I think all these things we're talking about in the writing, and you must take some pleasure in this, are the reasons that you're able to attract such an incredible cast. I mean, you start with Daveed Diggs and you end with Ben Harper in an episode that will be taking place in almost a centennial of Mercy, Mercy Me. Just the quality of the writing's got had to be a magnet to get all this talent involved in this thing.
I think that a lot of the people who worked on the show with us care about some of the same things. I hope they care about them in very different ways than I do, because that is required. But more importantly, you know, the conversations that you have when you're trying to get a cast together are, you know, the appropriate questions that actors ask of a director or a writer about a character. And if it's not on the page, they're not going to do it. All of these people have a lot of other choices. And it was so gratifying to me to have people say yes, and to have them really dig into these parts. It was a very rewarding artistic experience, I think, for me, every bit as much as it was an act of protest or rebellion.
Well, there aren't many shows that go from, oh, gee, I don't know, Daveed Diggs to Leslie Uggams to Meryl Streep to ending up with Kit Harington and Sienna Miller, with the stop with Dave Eggers in the middle. But that show would be Extrapolations, which is on Apple Plus TV. My guest is its creator, Scott Seaburn. Scott, thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you for having me. So be a dear world. Take your medicine, dear world. Keep your pressure down, dear
world. And get well soon. Writer-director Scott C. Burns has dealt with the projects based in real-life apocalypses, as does his new work for Apple Plus TV, the series Extrapolations. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
So make your recovery quick, world. We're sick of having a...
I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treat. Writer and cultural historian Abraham Josephine Reisman, who's mastered a specific take on forceful thinkers who brought their own takes to an existing culture and made them massively successful. For The Treat, she examines a work by someone who single-handedly transformed science fiction and became a force to be reckoned with, Philip K. Dick.
My name is Abraham Josephine Reisman, and this is The Treat. One of my favorite books of all time is The Man in the High Castle by Philip K. Dick. I read it for the first time when I was in eighth grade and proceeded to understand virtually none of it, but it completely amazed me. It's the story of an alternate world. In fact, it was one of the earliest mainstream depictions of an alternate universe, where the Nazis and the Japanese Empire won World War II, and it's set in the United States of that alternate world as of 1962, when the novel was published. Dick was such a pioneer in that he understood sci-fi works best when you fixate on the mundane, the quotidian. His sci-fi is not, and then the space cavalry rode into battle and 1,000 ships fired their lasers. It's always, my friend killed herself yesterday and my mood organ is on the fritz. And that means I've been really depressed. you know, and that brings you in. You're like, okay, who's this friend? What the hell is a mood organ? And now you're really interested.
Their eyes, warm not only with human bond, but with the shared enjoyment of the art objects he sold, their mutual tastes and satisfactions, remained fixed on him. They were thanking him for having things like these for them to see, pick up, and examine. Handle, perhaps, without even buying.
You're not the same after you finish a dick novel, or even just like a dick sentence sometimes. You know, he really understood that language is a virus in a good way. You know, if you have a good aphorism or a good little turn of phrase, it can just burrow its way into a person's head. And, it, you know, he used that power for good. What I love about The Man in the High Castle is it's a thrilling adventure ride that is ultimately about the fact that no matter what happens in history, no matter how much you might fantasize about a pivot point where if things had gone differently, the world would be all sunshine and rainbows, we're always living in a dystopia. We're always living in a bad timeline. We're always living in a place where there are challenges and life is hard and short, but that's the nature of being, and you have to find meaning within that context.
Writer and cultural historian Abraham Josephine Reisman, the author of the book True Believer, The Rise and Fall of Stan Lee, and the upcoming book, Ringmaster, Vince McMahon and the Unmaking of America. Her treat was the novel, The Man in the High Castle, by Philip K. Dick. Past treats, such as one from writer Joe Coscarelli, can be heard at kcrw.com/thetreat. And listen to our interviews with award winners and nominees at kcrw.com/FYC. As someone who inspired me once said, that's about all, y'all. Rebecca Mooney produces and edits the show, which was mixed this week by Katie Gilchrist. And we had help, which we can always use, from Anna Bust and Laura Kondarajan. To better days, people all over the world. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.